Right, we're now going to our first panel session. We've got a really esteemed group of experts with us. I'm going to start on my far right-hand side, and I've already briefly introduced Riot Games, but delighted to have with us Alban Deschelot, Head of Sponsorship and Business Development Manager, eSport Riot Games, on my far right. Dr. Bridget McConnell, CBE, who many of you will know, who is the Chief Executive here of Glasgow Life. Dimitri Kerkensis, Deputy Secretary of the Bureau International de Expositions. Many of you know it's Expo. And Dimitri was telling me this morning he's got a big vote on Friday for the 2025 venue. Next to Dimitri is Ansley O'Neill, Olympic Programme Commission Manager for the International Olympic Committee. And on my right here is John Dutton, Chief Executive of Rugby League World Cup 2021. So the focus of this session is envisaging the future major event sector. And what we're going to do is go through each of the panel sessions to give their thoughts, their honest thoughts, their bold thoughts and ambitious thoughts about the subject matter. We'll then move into some specific questions which we've got for each panelist and then open to the floor. So I'm going to start with Bridget just to give her thoughts from a Glasgow and Scottish perspective about the future of major event sector.
Well, thank you, Paul. And it's great to be here and to see everyone back in Glasgow. And it's also great to hear that this event is expanding. I'm known in some quarters as Pollyanna because I always try to make things seem really positive. So do forgive me for the few statements I'm going to just make. In terms of the future of events for certainly Glasgow and Scotland, Brexit is going to be an issue. For the first time ever last week, we were told by a major international conference that the uncertainty around Brexit was their main reason for not coming to the city. And if that trend continues, that will be a major issue for us. But more significantly, and I know everyone talks about money, but I'm a grandmother. I have been working for a very, very long time, and I have lived through a number of recessions, and I have never, ever been in the situation we are at the moment. Audit Scotland earlier this year published a report which said that within the next 5 years, local authorities, like Glasgow City Council, who fund so many events in Glasgow and Scotland, need to spend nearly 5% more of their total budget on social care and health. Now, that maybe doesn't sound much, but can I tell you, for those of you who know Glasgow Life, that 5% is everything we do. All the museums, all the libraries, all the community centres, all the events, all the arts programmes, all the concert halls, and nearly 3,000 staff being made redundant. That's what 5% over that period of time represents. I will caveat all of that by saying we are, in Scotland and in the UK, a rich country. What is bust is how we are actually delivering things. And it leads me on to my next point, that actually people not only need to see more value for money. Paul mentioned earlier the health and other impacts that are going to be driving so much of the public investment into events and other services. That's definitely going to be a trend, and that will continue. And I think in Glasgow, we've been leading the way in showing the relevance in terms of the relation of events to our wider development, community, health, education programmes. And that will continue. And finally, my next point is about the innovation that Paul mentioned. In this crazy world that we live in, I sometimes think I've died and gone to hell when I look at the news. It is mad, and you have no idea what's going to happen, not just one day to the next, but 1 hour to the next. Well, I was telling Dimitri earlier that in Glasgow we have four seasons in 1 hour. Certainly, the need for innovation. There are going to be events created that we don't know what they are yet. I think the European Champions this year is an example of the creation and innovation in the event sector, and I think we're going to have to see more of that. So a huge bit of gloom and doom at the outset. We do have the money, but actually we can't keep bleeding money out of our health service. Last week, the ministers for health at UK and Scottish government levels spoke about us needing to change the whole paradigm to become a service about prevention and people's quality of life. And the events circuit, the events programming in this country has to be part of that. So on that point, I'll just finish.
Thanks, Bridget. I'm sure we'll pick up on that, but it's an interesting theme that touches on what I opened up as to where events probably need to be over the next 5 to 10 years. Next to Bridget, Alban, Riot Games, which I knew nothing about, I have to say, until a couple of weeks ago when we put this panel together. Can you give us your perspective on how you see esports, Riot Games, fitting into that sector in the future?
Thanks. Great transition. I think it's going to be difficult to talk of some dramatic context you have here. I think for us, it's a bit more like lighter. We have a new kids on the block. I would say the future is now for us. We aspire to create a multi-generation sports. Riot Games is a game publisher. So we created a video game 10 years ago that has been massively successful. So we talk about 100 million people playing this game every year. 100 million. What's interesting for us is to see this as a way, when we created the esports platform, to build some aspiration for the players. The same way the Federation used like the pros to inspire the grassroots. We started by the World Cup, and now we're creating step by step the different layers of a multi-generation premium sports. So we had now 3 international events, 14 regional leagues, and as of last year, 13 national leagues in Europe. And as you can see, I mean, we are building the same layers and the same infrastructure, the same governance at any federation. The only difference is that we own the sports, we own the leagues, and we create our own broadcasts. So we have kind of an end-to-end production facility, and we deal all this internally. So Riot Games is a game publisher that also does sports. And for us, the future is clearly to go deeper. I think we are already young. I mean, 85% of our audience is below 25. We are very international. We started international. Now we try to be more local. And we are digital. I mean, we don't broadcast on TV. We are 100% online. We are looking at OTT as a development, not to go broader on TV, because with this 100 million of players, our focus is to build this and to give more reason for the players to become fans. So a little bit like opposite direction of the traditional sports, I would say, in terms of instead of trying to go broader, we try to go deeper. Instead of trying to be global, we try to go local. And in terms of like trying to be more agile, I think we are trying to build the governance that will allow us to last for decades. So that's kind of where we are today.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to Ansley and give an IOC perspective, really, in terms of, we were talking upstairs just about the challenge that the IOC face now in terms of that sports program and, you know, how you might see it look in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most interesting challenges that we have for the future is that the Olympic Games are such an old property. They have been around for such a long time. But we do see that they have a really positive future, that there's a lot going on. And one of the exciting things that we're trying to look at in terms of the way we put together the sports program is not just the urbanization of sports, not just the way that sports are delivered in the future, but really how do you continue to appeal to an audience all over the world when sports are more and more becoming topically relevant within different regions. So you need to continue to create a package and put sports together that will remain relevant all over the world, especially when you have populations up and coming in India, in China, in Southeast Asia, that you want to continue to have those sports in the program that are going to be incredibly exciting and relevant, but balance that also for the rest of the world. So we see that there's quite a lot of exciting things that are happening, but it's not just around necessarily the sports program. It's also a way looking at how you deliver what's on the field of play, how you deliver what's around the field of play, the package and the entertainment package that fans want and spectators want, and the engagement really with the population outside of what's actually happening in the venues. So I think we as a property are looking at a broader perspective of our model from the content perspective, really trying to drive what's happening on the field, but also outside the venues.
I'm going to move to Dimitri next, and obviously a slightly different property, Expo. It's not a sporting property as such, Dubai in 2020. It'd be interesting to understand where you see, say, 25 and 30 is going to go in terms of your property, and what will change, you know, to appeal to the customer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Paul. And it's a pleasure to be back at Host City this year. It's true, it's slightly different as a proposition when you're talking about a World Expo and where it's going to go in the future. It's a trend that we've been seeing, let's say, recently, where Dubai won the right to host Expo 2020, and it's the first expo in the Middle Eastern region. Just last year, in November, this time last year, Buenos Aires in Argentina won the right to host a specialized expo for 2023, and again, first time that we will be having an expo in the Latin American continent. So there's been an interesting shift. I don't mean to say that now countries only want to go to new locations, but it definitely seems to be one of the aspects that they're looking at. It's, do we want to go take an expo somewhere where it's been tried and tested and we know what the result will be like, or do we want to try somewhere new? And we seem to be at this crossroad at the moment, still in the middle. I don't know what will happen for 2025. We will know on Friday when the vote takes place, and better not to talk about that at the moment, as I know 170 governments are currently gathering in Paris today and tomorrow to prepare for the vote itself. For 2030, as you mentioned, again, this is an interesting point of view. We're already seeing cities and countries that are starting to express their interest in hosting 2030. So although they know that officially they cannot come and be a candidate until 2021, we know that the government of Korea, for example, has been pushing the city of Busan for the past 3-4 years, hosting an annual forum, trying to get the people to understand, the citizens, what is the point of having this expo and why they want to have this expo. And I think this leads me on to a key point. It's, what is our future? Our future for the expo is really a question of being able to communicate the reasons why we want to have these events in these cities. These are slightly different from the other events I'm hearing today. These are presence-based events. That means that governments have to spend to be present in the expo, and people actually have to visit. It's not an event that you can see through virtual reality or through your computer. Expos have tried. Expo 2010 Shanghai had Expo Online. They've tried to have TV channels broadcast more and more of the expo. There may be very interesting things, conferences and so on, that take place in an expo that you may want to watch on TV, but the only way to really experience it is to be present. And that means millions of visitors being able to come onto the site during a 3 or 6 month period. This means a lot of infrastructure that needs to be put in place, infrastructure that you have to communicate properly to your citizens. Why are we doing this? Has this already been planned for the future and we're just using the expo to catalyze it? Or is this something that we see as a benefit for the future of the city and the region? So there's a lot of different aspects that go into this point of view on the expo and where we see them moving. But for me, one of the key things truly is the correct communication as to why we're doing these events, what we aim to get from them, and what they can give the citizens of the host city in the future.
John, in terms of 2021 Rugby League World Cup, you're a few years out, so what's your vision for the concept in 2021?
Thank you, Paul. Good morning. Yeah, 3 years to go for us. I guess I see lots of opportunity. We're going to deliver a major sporting event at a time when the world is changing in front of our eyes. Did I think 2, 3, 5 years ago I'd be sat on a panel inspired by someone talking about Riot Games? Absolutely not. And the way that people are consuming sport and entertainment is changing, and therefore we have to change as event organisers. Our tournament is built around a number of principles. First of all, innovation. We will stage the first ever eSports Rugby League World Cup. Ask me what that is. I can't tell you exactly. As a 46-year-old that downloaded Twitch the other day, I'm still slightly baffled by it. But we will find out, and it's in pursuit of Generation Z and millennials, people that wouldn't normally engage with our tournament. Our second focus area will be inclusivity. We'd like to stage the most inclusive sporting tournament ever. We've already taken a decision that our elite men's competition will be run alongside the Women's World Cup and run alongside the Wheelchair World Cup. Also, we'll stage a physical disability festival. We'll have a Masters tournament for over 35s. We'll have tag and touch. And we've taken that decision because we want to treat every athlete with equality and put the women and wheelchair athletes on the same platform as the men. And that will mean we have to work really hard, but we will also reap the benefits of that. And I think the third area is around social benefit rather than pure economic impact. We were talking before about cost of staging the event against the economic impact derived. We're in pursuit of a legacy programme about engaging with people rather than pure participation per se. So we have a dance programme, a choir programme, a culture programme, a heritage programme, a big public health programme focused around mental health, dementia and loneliness, an international development programme focused around trade. All areas that we want to engage with people. My target is to move the dial from 500,000 tickets sold in 2013 to 750,000 tickets sold in 2021, a 50% increase at a time when I think the world is changing in front of our eyes.
Thanks very much. I mean, it's three key themes that our panel have picked up there. It's around diversity, sustainability, and transformational change. And I think that's quite a shift for the events industry, you know, where traditionally we've put on events that have been basically around gross value added or full-time equivalents and media value. And I think, you know, we've got to wake up to that. I'm going to dig a little bit deeper now with each of our panelists on something specific. I'm going to turn to Bridget first and talk about Glasgow have been incredibly successful at wedding culture and sport onto the same platform. It was demonstrated in 2014 and again this year. It'd be interesting to understand from Bridget, A, why Glasgow have done that, but B, what the lasting impact of that is.
Okay. I think Glasgow, right from very early days in developing events and bidding for events, was clear that they could be important in their own right, but they also had to be milestones in terms of a wider health, education, culture and sport agenda. And that has encouraged very much existing programmes, both ones that we do through Glasgow Life, but also in the third sector, to expand and develop their sports development, their coach training, etc. So linking, having an event with other policies, it's absolutely a no-brainer. It makes such sense, but it also makes meaning off the event for the public. They get it. They understand why you're doing this, that you're not just throwing money at a big fancy event that comes helicoptering in and then leaves. So for us too, the combination of culture and sport in our programmes, I think this year in the European Championships, the messages I was picking up from people who were taking part in the free culture and sport events at Glasgow Green was that it was seamless. They didn't see it as either sport or culture. It was about communities coming together, doing things that were making them happier, healthier, and they felt a very direct benefit from the investment of the Scottish Government and the city in that event.
Alban, moving on to you. Many of you probably don't know that Alban was a rugby player who's now moved into esports, quite a different world. What do you see, and I say this in terms of 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18 months, because it's such a fast-changing market. Where do you see esports, say, in 18 months, 2 years' time?
Yeah, it's fast pace, that's true. I think usually we say that 1 year in esports is the equivalent of 7 years in real life. So I would say in 1 year we'll be in Paris. I mean, we just announced that Paris will be the host for a World Championship final. So it's probably the first time ever that we see in advance for the next 3 years where the World Cup will go. I think it's a big shift for us. I think from moving from let's plan for the next event and organize the best show possible in 3 months, we just moved to a 3-year roadmap that will allow our host city partners like Paris and also the economic partners, the fans, to plan in advance. So that's actually, again, the way we are shifting at the moment. Instead of like keeping what we have been always, which is like a studio development mode, like very agile and ready to go for the next one, we try to build the infrastructure and the planning that allows us to invite, for example, host cities to apply. So we just selected our host cities for the European Championship for the next 2 years. We're going to start the new bidding process in January for 2021. That's a new thing for us. And obviously, we have to hire some consultants and new resources and capabilities to help us grow and develop these capabilities to be able to accommodate these new processes.
Ainsley, you started to touch on content being king there. The urbanisation of sport is an interesting topic. Do you ever see the day where the IOC will have Olympic sports in the non-traditional venues?
Well, this is something which actually we're in the middle of discussing right now. It's not something that we're waiting for the future, because I think what we saw down in Buenos Aires recently for the Youth Olympic Games, taking sport to the people, just as Bridget mentioned as well, we want that experience when people come to our event. It's not just about what's happening on the field of play. Of course, we want the best competition in the world, but we want people to be able to engage beyond the field of play. So this actually goes very hand in hand with the urbanization of sports and thinking differently, taking sports necessarily out of the venues that they may have always been in and taking them to the people. You see a lot of this happening right now with what athletics is doing. You see a lot of other sports trying out different models and different layouts for what venues are like, basically to allow more standing room for people to be able to come into the venue, be outside the venue, but still be able to participate. And this is changing everything. I mean, you look at the way we ticket events. You look at what a secure perimeter of a venue means. You look at the way that you activate within that perimeter. You're going to have initiation events. You're going to have showcases. You're going to have different kinds of cultural interactions. I mean, what I really liked about our Youth Olympic Games in Buenos Aires is that you had people coming and families coming and bringing their kids. But as everybody knows who has a kid under 10 years old, you might not get that attention span for very long to actually sit there and watch a full match or a full game. So you need to be able to have other things to engage them outside the venue. And I think what we're going to see in the future is that the Olympic Games is going to be incredibly adapted to what the fans want to consume for the future. So the way that we deliver the event and the way that we're looking at what is the field of play and defining a venue, that's going to change in the future. So it's likely that what you will see in Paris and Los Angeles are going to be very, very different models from what has been happening in the past. But it's still with that traditional Olympic value, still with that traditional approach of Olympic sports, best competition, best experience that you can have both for spectators and athletes.
Dimitri, we've all seen the impact of Expo in Shanghai, particularly where the numbers were mind-boggling. Milan, obviously, last time, and now we move to Dubai. I guess for lots of us, Expo is hugely expensive. How do you justify the cost against the sustainability?
Well, is it working? Yes. I agree that an Expo itself is probably a very expensive event. I think we have to separate the cost into two things. One is the infrastructure cost. If anyone believes that a six-month or a three-month event can bring enough revenue to recuperate infrastructure costs of new airport terminals or train lines or metro lines, I think they're very much deluded. It does not happen. That's why one of the key points that we look at when we're looking at bidding cities is why do they want to have this event? What is the reason for the development of the city or for the country or the region that they want to go ahead with this? Are they trying to expand the city, expand its networks? Is this in the urban planning ideas and scopes of the host city in the future? So this is an idea that you could catalyze these kind of infrastructure projects by having an expo itself bring them forward by a decade or so. On the other hand, the cost of operating an expo, it's something that, in all honesty, a well-managed expo should not have a deficit. In good, let's say, under good circumstances, it should break even. In many cases, they make a profit. An example would be Aichi Expo in 2005 in Japan, where they made a $110 million profit on their operating costs for the expo. In Milan, I believe the government produced a report showing profits of about 14 million euros. So the event itself can bring in a certain amount of money. Of course, afterwards, a lot of impact studies will talk about the tourism impact and the VAT on that you've gained from sales and so on. And it's true, there is a very big difference here. We're talking about an event that draws actual people in. And you need, like in Shanghai, to have 17 million visitors. In Milan, we had over 20 million. Dubai, again, is expecting over 20 million people in a six-month period. Even our smaller expos in Kazakhstan in 2017 saw 4 million visitors. So these are events that, over a relatively short period of time, have quite a lot of draw and can actually get the economy turning during those months. On the question of sustainability, again, it's a question of legacy planning. It's something that we request from our candidates at the early stage, is to give us the legacy plans of this expo. What do they want it to be? What will it be for the citizens? What will it be for the city? Why should they do this? And we want to ensure that we don't leave any white elephants behind. This is a key issue because we have seen it in the past. And it's something that we have managed to avoid, let's say, since 2000, that not leaving too much behind that would be useless for the city. So it's an interesting question. We have to look at this at a very early stage of the project itself, when they start applying to be a host city during their candidature. But it's something that, of course, in a 10-year period will evolve and will change, and we have to work with them to make sure, and again, what I said at the beginning, to communicate this, to make sure that people understand why the country, why the city wants to undertake such an event and what it will offer them.
I guess succession planning is an interesting topic for all of us on a daily basis now, and if we look at future leaders, turning to John, what new skills do you think will be required for the future major event leaders?
Yeah, good question, Paul. I mean, I'm staging an event in 3 years' time. So first of all, there's a lot of future gazing involved. I think leaders in the future of major sports and events will have to be more disruptive, will have to be more innovative. We've heard about Riot Games and eSports, I think, which will play a more significant role in people staging major events in the future. Digital and technology, what's the role of augmented reality? What's the role of artificial intelligence and blockchain and all of these developing technologies that will continue to develop at a rapid pace? I went to a conference earlier in the year and heard from Rio Ferdinand about his football career. And he said Twitter didn't exist when he was playing football. So his analysis was going home and watching Match of the Day at 10:30 on a Saturday night. And yet now professional footballers are analysed in a nanosecond, because and that's in my life, my recent lifetime. So the world is changing, and I think future leaders will need to change, develop more skills, also prove the case to government, much more about social benefit rather than economic impact, and be wholly innovative.
Thanks. It's now your time to open up. We've got a really talented panel here. We've got 5 minutes or so for some questions. If you could say who you are and where you're from. I think there's some microphones, isn't there? I see Olga's got a microphone. The floor is yours. First question. Don't be shy. There's one at the back there.
Hi, I'm Kate Cullinan from Wilson Derrin Derrin, and I've got a question from Ashley. I was working with the International Federation and how you are starting to manage their expectation on what can be delivered as a venue.
Yeah, no, thank you for your question. I couldn't agree more. And that's one of the important pieces of work that we're doing right now, is to really sit down with each federation. You know, every single sport is different, and the reason that they're in the Olympic Games is different. But what we try to do at the IOC is talk to them about where do they project themselves in the future? Because what you often have are many sports which haven't very, very well developed a 10-year plan. They're working on athlete cycles, as opposed to necessarily legacy cycles well into the future. So in terms of the way that we look at it, we have a new program, the new norm, I don't know if you've heard about it, 118 recommendations for how to potentially save money in the future. And we are taking those recommendations, and we're actually sitting down with each federation and saying, right, what do you want to do for the future of your sport? And how does that fit within a cost savings matrix that allows us to really examine where your sport is going, but also make sure that it's still sustainable, that it's still reasonable in terms of the way that we're hosting events, that we're building your venue and that sort of thing. So I think there's a lot of work that we're doing directly with the federations to be able to sit with them and understand their sport, but then we also come in and we say, right, this is the framework that we'd like to work in, and these are the kinds of cost savings that we'd like to make. How does that affect your sport, and what can we do to work with you on that?
Next question. Can we get the microphone? Thanks, Olga.
Hi, my name is Rita. I'm from AFL Architects, based in the UK, and regardless of my age, I'm an esports player, mainly because of my child. So I was attracted to that world. I kind of know it a bit, and I'm starting to design for esports too, which is quite a challenge. So we usually design for sports and now for esports. I think at the beginning of this debate, Paul put a question, which was, would ever esports be part of the Olympics? And I think no one answered that. I think it was more of a challenge than a real question, but I would like to know the answer for that.
Will any sport ever be part of the Olympics?
That's a good answer.
No, but in all honesty, I think what's going on right now in the Olympic world is very, very interesting. You are looking at the Olympic movement as kind of going through a little bit of an identity crisis. Not to say that we're always going to be changing or we're always going to be staying the same, but we're really exploring what it means to be Olympic. We're exploring what it means to be a sport. We're exploring what it means to, you know, as I said earlier, deliver something on a venue. And one of the things that we are doing, especially through some of the statements that have been made over the past year through our Olympic summit, we hosted an esports forum as well between the IOC and the esports industry. We're trying to understand more about the world outside of the Olympics. Because I think this is one thing that people often think that, well, you know, the Olympics are such a traditional property that they only deal with their traditional sports and they're not really always aware of what's happening in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's really not true. We are making an effort to educate ourselves about what esport is, about esport athletes, you know, what they go through in terms of training, nutrition, all of this sorts of stuff. I was just having this discussion earlier. And also just, you know, understanding the whole ecosystem, because I think one of the things that you probably know very well and a lot of people in this room know very well is there's so many different games out there. There's so many different games. There's so many properties. And it absolutely has potential in terms of tapping into the youth demographic, but I can't say for certain that it'll ever be a part of the Olympics right now because we don't know enough about it to be able to say what parts we're interested in and what parts align best with what we're doing. So that's part of what's going on right now. Inside the IOC, we have an esports leadership group that we're bringing together best of both industries to be able to sit down and discuss what should be kind of the integration strategy on this. We know that it's affecting all of our different sports, from rugby to sailing to cycling. I mean, you can see that all these different sports are trying to get into it and trying to activate it through their own esport world championships for their sport. So we're trying to educate ourselves, but also then develop a policy that we can place around that. So it's kind of a long way of saying, I can't say what I don't know because it's so far in the future, but we're trying our best to be educated about our approach, and I hope over the course of the next years we'll be able to develop more concrete policies around that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Time for one more question. Any more question? No? Okay, well I'm just going to... Oh, we have got one. Sorry.
Thank you. Daniel Baxter, Glasgow Caledonian University, and I thought since there was no last question I would ask this one. What do you see the role of academia in the future of major event sector? How do you see us playing our part?
What I suggest is let's go down the panel and each one of you just give a quick 1 minute of your views on that. So start with Alban.
So I think for us, we have a very particular problem, like anything I've said since today. All pros stop their careers around 25. And I think we look at the academia world as a potential partner to help us help them transition in their next career. And I think there's a bigger potential for us maybe than any other sport. So that would be for me an area where I see a big potential.
Bridget?
Academia has already played quite a big role in many of the events that we've all been discussing. And I think in the future, as we need more evidence base, we are almost anticipating things we don't know yet. I think the role of academia could be central, and I think having applied research is going to be really crucial in future, particularly when we're trying to win the case for politicians and public to support budgets for events and other programmes.
Dimitri?
Thank you. I think that's actually a very important question, especially for expos, because I don't think you can separate expos from academia. Expos are thematic-based events. That means that the theme itself, the development of the theme and so on, academia plays a very important role in how this theme is developed. Countries and cities bid on these events 10 years in advance. That means that when they're looking at topics such as sustainable urban development and climate change and so on, it is through academia where they're taking the information and how they will develop it, what countries will show, and academia from all over the world, because each country will use its academic resources to show the content, their content, and what they're doing on this theme in the expo itself. So I honestly don't believe you can separate the two.
Yeah, similar to the other panelists. I mean, it's incredibly important for us, the academic world. You know, firstly, in terms of making sure that athletes are getting a good education, it's something where we align a number of programs that we do that are certified by universities around the world, so that you can go, and if you're an athlete who's constantly traveling and you're unable to attend university in kind of a normal setting, we make sure that there's online resources available for you to continue your education. And we found this to be very, very successful through our Athlete Career Learning Gateway and a few other programs. I would say also from the perspective of just educating ourselves on the topic earlier of esports, but in general, you know, we have such big questions that we grapple with in the Olympic program. You know, what is a sport? What is youth? What is an urban sport? How do you quantify the impacts that climate change is having on sports? How do you quantify the impacts that different changes in technology are having on sports? You know, we can't do that in a vacuum. And what I like about working with universities is there's this openness to be able to ask those questions and apply a really rigorous, you know, academic approach. And in the end, we educate ourselves more, but we also are building those relationships. So we have an Olympic Studies Center through the IOC that we try to allocate grants to researchers, usually at the PhD level, but then in terms of just having relationships with local business schools, business programs around the world, we also try to engage with students at all different levels to make sure that in case there is an interest in studying something Olympic, that we try to help give them our biggest questions of the day and say, right, tackle it, we're interested.
John?
Yeah, very significant for us. In the next couple of months, we will announce a partnership with a university that's predicated on research and also volunteering, and we're really excited by that. But also, I think it comes back to Paul's question about graduates are the future leaders of sports events, and I think that's something that we should all take very seriously.
Thank you. Sadly, we've come to the end. I could talk all morning to these guys because it's so inspirational and interesting. I guess some key themes for me, I think... we've got to innovate, we've got to challenge, disrupt, whatever that means. And it's certain that the landscape in the future will be very fluid. And if you embrace it, it'll be an exciting journey. So let's put your hands together, please, and thank Alban, Bridget, Dimitri, Ansley, and John. Thank you.